It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll review the case of Adnan Syed, the man at the center of the first season of the hit podcast, Serial.
First, Governor Scott Walker joined Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence at a rally in Milwaukee last night, and the economy was front and center at that rally.
Walker praised Pence's leadership in Indiana, saying that he had done, quote, a tremendous job as governor, and highlighted a drop in unemployment in his state over the last several years. Pence, in turn, called Walker the, quote, best governor in America.
The Trump campaign has been paying a lot of attention to the Midwest and focusing on the economy. Earlier this week, Donald Trump gave a speech to the Detroit Economic Club. Hillary Clinton followed suit by talking about her plan for the economy in the same city. Steve Deller joins us now to talk more about how the Republican ticket is focusing on the economy in the Midwest. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, from what you've seen and heard so far, how are you seeing the Trump-Pence campaign make an economic appeal to the Midwest?
I think that the focus on the unemployment rate is probably the only piece of good economic news that they have to point to. Because when you look at some of the other economic indicators, particularly things like income, Indiana's not doing very well. So they're looking for that one little piece of nugget of good news, and it's the unemployment rate, so we're going to focus on that.
Donald Trump, in some of his speeches, has focused on the bad news for the so-called Rust Belt economy states as a way to target President Obama. With Mike Pence, with Scott Walker, they've got to make the case, I guess, the national economy not great, but the Wisconsin and Indiana economies under Republican governors are doing better. Is there a big difference, or are we mostly tracking the national economy?
Well, there is a difference. I mean, generally, the state's economies do track the national economies. That's generally true. But you see that some states are doing a little bit better than the national economy. Some states are doing a little bit worse. And I think that if you look at Wisconsin and Indiana, we're actually doing a little bit worse than the national economy. In Wisconsin, we've had a painfully slow recovery. The unemployment rate is the one good indicator, but unemployment in Wisconsin has historically been low. It's always been below the national average, and it has been throughout the Great Recession and the recovery. That is the one good piece of economic news. But you look at all the other indicators, Wisconsin continues to lag behind, and Indiana actually makes Wisconsin look pretty good.
Donald Trump earlier this week hit some traditional Republican economic points, and Mike Pence did that too. Tax cuts, simplified tax code, lower regulations for businesses. What would that do here in the Midwest?
I think that it's kind of, when you think about economic growth and you think about businesses contributing to economic growth, there's really two ways that businesses tend to approach profitability. One is kind of to drive costs down. By driving costs down, they can maximize profits. They do that by driving labor costs down, taxes down, regulation costs down. But that's a very short-term strategy. That doesn't really feed into long-term economic growth. For long-term economic growth, you need innovation. You need investment in research and development. You need investment in education. Taxes, regulations, things like that really don't influence innovative firms. So are you thinking short term or are you thinking long term? I think part of the problem with the Wisconsin economy is that we've been so focused on lowering operating costs that we've kind of lost sight of kind of the long term need to invest in education and invest in innovation.
Now, Donald Trump has broken with mainstream Republican orthodoxy on the trade issue. How much do you see the way free trade agreements have been structured, could be structured in the future with this Trans-Pacific Partnership, affecting especially the manufacturing industry in Wisconsin and the Midwest?
Actually, the TPP really is an extension of a trade agreement that we already have with a lot of Pacific Rim countries. What the TPP does is essentially add a couple of small countries like Vietnam and Southeast Asia onto the larger Pacific Rim. So the TPP in and of itself really isn't that big of a deal. I think part of the problem is that we're afraid of facing this competition. And when the economy is struggling, we're kind of grasping at straws to try to do something. And looking at international trade as a potential problem is something to grasp at. The problem, though, is that we're actually opening up export markets. One of the things that's been driving Wisconsin dairy industry for the last 10 years or so is expanding export markets. Of course, it ebbs and flows, you know, as commodity markets do. But what we have to think about is the potential opportunities that opening up export markets does for Wisconsin firms.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison about the economy and the presidential race, especially messages focused by both tickets, really, to us here in the Midwest. Steve, one thing that there's been criticism of President Obama and Hillary Clinton, in some cases from within the Democratic Party, is that when businesses are disrupted by international trade, there's winners and losers anywhere because of international trade. The idea up front was, okay, no problem. We're going to help retrain workers displaced by trade. We're going to find ways to replace the economic opportunities they have. The criticism, here it comes, that hasn't happened enough. Is that true?
I think that is true. I think that you can look at this from two ways. One is, what's changing in terms of the demand for labor? What kind of jobs are we generating? The other is, what is the types of skills that workers have? The Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development put out a forecast a couple of years back looking 10 years into the future in terms of where the job growth is coming from. And in Wisconsin, you could almost break it up into three equal pieces. One third of the job growth requires some type of college education. Another third requires just a high school diploma. The final third doesn't require a high school diploma. So the question really is that what kind of jobs is the economy generating? We're generating, I think, too many poverty-level type jobs. This is not new. This has been going on, depending on which source of data you want to look at, this has been going on since the late 1970s. It's only gotten to a point where it's really starting to, people are starting to notice it.
Both campaigns have said their policies will help boost manufacturing jobs in particular. Donald Trump, by what we were talking about, tax cuts, regulation cuts, changing trade agreements. The Clinton campaign, with some of the investment that it sounded like you were talking about. But if we bring those manufacturing jobs back, are they the same manufacturing jobs? They're higher tech. Are these now that college-level job, not the job that the high school diploma worker used to be able to get?
Exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head, is that if you look at manufacturing in Wisconsin, we've actually been doing very, very good if you look at it from the terms of gross domestic product. We're doing great. The problem is that growth in output has been being performed with fewer and fewer jobs. We're shifting toward more technology-oriented production processes. Those require a different skill set. You almost need to have a degree in electrical engineering to work some of this equipment. That's the future of manufacturing in the U.S. and in Wisconsin, I think, is not large-scale repetitive manufacturing, but smaller-scale batch production that is highly flexible and, again, innovative.
So if it's not manufacturing for those jobs for a wider audience at higher pay, where could those jobs, say for that high school diploma worker who used to 30, 40 years ago have a good shot at that factory or mine job or whatever the case may be, where are those jobs going to come from, those higher paying, lower college degree requiring jobs?
I think if you look at where a lot of the job growth is coming from in the U.S. economy right now and in Wisconsin, it's coming from new business startups. I think that we need to start looking more towards entrepreneurship and helping folks start and run their own businesses. I think that that's really where a lot of the job growth is going to be coming from. It's not going to be from large-scale manufacturers hiring lots and lots of people. It's going to be coming from smaller businesses that are startup businesses or small businesses that are in that initial growth phase. I think that's where a lot of the job growth is coming from, and I think we need to reflect that in our education policies.
Steve, as we wrap up, I'm going to ask a big question with a short answer. How much do governors and presidents matter when it comes to making these things happen?
Not much.
we're at the whim of international economic forces? Or?
It is what governors and presidents have is a bully pulpit. They can essentially set the tone of the conversation. They can kind of rally people. And they can kind of use that bully pulpit and set the stage for how we're thinking about doing economic development.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He joins today to talk about the Trump campaign's plan for the economy after Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence stopped in Milwaukee last night.
Millions of Americans were captivated in late 2014 when the hit podcast Serial took the world by storm. The 12-episode series tackled the story of Adnan Syed, his trial and subsequent murder conviction for the death of his former girlfriend, Haemin Lee. The podcast sparked national interest in Syed's case, and a Maryland judge vacated Adnan's conviction just this past June, granting him a new trial.
Our next guest says that while the story Serial told was true, it wasn't the whole truth or the whole story. In a new book, she digs deeper into the case of Adnan Syed and examines some of the bigger questions left unanswered by Serial and explains why she thinks he should go free.
Rabia Chowdhury joins us now. She's an attorney, a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and a national security fellow at the New America Foundation. She's also the co-host of the podcast Undisclosed and author of the new book, Adnan's Story, The Search for Truth and Justice After Serial. Rabia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So in that introduction, we mentioned all of the various titles you have. What we didn't mention is that you're also a very close friend to the Syed family. You were there the day Adnan was sentenced, and you were also responsible for reaching out to producer Sarah Koenig with Adnan's story, which led to the birth of Serial. So with all that in mind, how incredibly personal is this story for you?
It is very personal. I've watched this family suffer and Adnan suffer for 17 years, and I've known him since he was 13 years old. He's my younger brother's best friend and has been like a little brother to me. And just, you know, even as an attorney, but I didn't practice criminal defense, but still, even as an attorney, seeing this case up close and personal has always been a source of a lot of just anger at the system for me.
I don't think anyone could have predicted the success that that first season of Serial would go on to. It's kind of birthed the dreams of podcasters all over the place. But what do you think it was about Adnan Syed's story that just really resonated with people?
You know, I don't think Adnan's story, I mean, of course, it has its unique, very interesting elements and characters and people involved. But really, I think almost any wrongful conviction case that you can take, everything has to go wrong for you to end up with a wrongful conviction. And I think these stories are always compelling. Sometimes the storyteller is not as compelling, but in this case, Sarah is an amazing storyteller, and they just really crafted the narrative beautifully and unfolded the story really, really in a compelling way. So I don't know if it's hard for me to understand because, you know, obviously I'm so close to it. Mm-hmm. I always ask other people, why were you fascinated with it? You tell me.
So you write that while the story Serial told was true, it wasn't the whole truth or maybe the whole story. From your perspective, from where you were sitting so close to the family, but also someone with a legal background, what was missing in that very investigative and deep look at the case?
Well, you know, I mean, me and two other attorneys, Susan Simpson, Colin Miller, went on to do Undisclosed, our own podcast, in which we did kind of try to cover the things that Serial didn't, or, you know, we did it in a different way. We approached it from a legal and investigative standpoint. So some of the things that, you know, we wanted to talk about were was the technology involved. Serial did look a little bit at the cell phone stuff. Sarah herself never really examined it. She kind of had one of her producers or assistants, Dana Chivas, do it. And as far as we were concerned, they were wrong. They got the technology wrong. So we revisited that. And in fact, that became the basis for why he was eventually given a new trial very recently. We also looked at other things like, you know, we looked very closely at how and why the state's witness, Jay Wiles' statements changed. And Susan Simpson was able to identify exactly how the pattern of why they changed. We looked at the medical evidence, which I don't think Serial touched on at all.
No, I don't believe so.
Yeah, the autopsy report, the lividity, and these were really important issues because in a case where there wasn't a lot of real you know, evidence, tangible evidence, the autopsy report, the medical evidence was very, very important.
So I think that some people would say, well, he was represented by a lawyer. So if these things were so important, why didn't they come out in the first trial? What can you tell us about the representation that Adnan had?
Well, I mean, you know, Adnan is not the only one to ever have hired an attorney who didn't do their job properly. Ineffective assistance of counsel is a claim that we find actually quite common, especially in wrongful convictions. Like I said, everything has to go wrong there. In this particular case, Christina Gutierrez, who was hired because she had a wonderful reputation in her heyday, we did not know as a community she was really on her last legs. She was very sick in that last year or so. She had multiple illnesses. She had taken on, I think, 8 or 9 murder cases at the same time, which is an incredible caseload for any attorney. And she just wasn't able to perform. And in the couple of years after, she was not only disbarred for having really messed up the cases of almost 40 clients, but also she died. She was that ill.
Hmm. And given that, one would think that when there's proof that someone, especially in such a significant case, in a case that has so much importance for the person who is convicted, but also for the family and loved ones of the victim, that knowing that Ms. Gutierrez was not giving proper counsel, you would think that that would have been enough to get a new trial. Why was that not enough?
Well, I mean, procedurally, the way it works is you have to wait for a certain point in the appellate process before you can raise something like Christina Gutierrez's health. And that point is post-conviction relief. You have up until 10 years to file it. And because it costs a lot of money, it took many years to raise the money, we filed the post-conviction. We hired an attorney in 2008. It took a couple years to prepare. We filed it, I think, end of 2009. And that was something that was raised. But, you know, what's interesting is that the state, in the post-conviction, did everything they could to exclude the evidence of all of the complaints against her from the Attorney Grievance Commission, and also exclude all the medical evidence. And they actually won. The judge ruled in their favor. So none of that evidence was even allowed in. But in a common sense way, I mean, forget a legal analysis, but for anybody looking at this in a common sense way, you would say, why would you exclude evidence of this lady, of this attorney, who clearly had become almost incoherent by the end of her career? I think it's just very unfair, fundamentally unfair.
We're talking with Rabia Chowdhury. She's the author of Adnan's Story, The Search for Truth and Justice After Serial. Rabia, as we said, you are a very close friend of the family. You've known Adnan since he was a very young boy. Tell us what kind of person he is or was when you knew him.
You know, I used to joke with Adnan. I used to tell him to stay away from my brother because I said my brother will corrupt you. My brother's always been like kind of this alpha male jock type. And Adnan was always just very, very, just a very congenial, very kind person. He paid attention to everybody in his space, from the oldest to the youngest, and very non-confrontational. And anytime there was an issue, Adnan was the one who would always be the one to de-escalate any you know, problems. He would be the one to say, listen, if there's an argument, I'm sorry, let's just let this go. And, you know, in the 17 years he's been incarcerated, he's never once had an altercation. He's never once had a fight with another inmate because that's who he is. He just is not a confrontational or violent person, which is why this entire, you know, the charges against him are even more preposterous. It is completely divorced from his nature.
You say in your book that the legal system or any large system is really only the combined prejudices and ideas and biases of the people that are working within that. How do you see the issues of bias in the legal and criminal justice systems and how it plays out in a case like Adnan's?
I mean, I think, you know, research has shown that one of the biggest impacts that that leads us to things like over-incarceration, getting the wrong defendant, and even like disproportionate impact on certain communities like Black communities are cognitive biases, and all human beings have them. So everybody who touches a case is going to come to that case with their biases. In Adnan's case, from the very beginning, even before they knew that Haymin Lee had been murdered, even before a body had been found, they didn't even know what happened to her, they began pulling Adnan's like criminal records. I mean, he didn't have any, but they began looking at him as a suspect, and that was because the entire theory of the state's case was he was a Muslim boy who they had broken up, and so it was like an honor killing. The Muslim honor killing was the theory of their case. So they were heavily biased against him simply because of his religion and ethnicity.
So the latest development, as we mentioned earlier, is that a Maryland judge vacated Adnan's conviction this past June, granting him a new trial. But the state's attorney general recently announced a challenge to that ruling and requested that a new trial be put on hold while the appeals process plays out. What do you see will be the next step of this, and how quickly might there be that new trial for Adnan?
Well, you know, what the state filed, because they don't actually have a right to appeal, they don't have an automatic right, they have to ask permission to appeal. So what they filed was actually that application for permission. That application could easily be dismissed, because many are dismissed by the appellate court. If it is not dismissed, there will be then a full-blown hearing on this on the issues that they raised. We filed a cross appeal already, and but if it is denied, which, again, it's likely that it could be denied, then the judge's ruling stands that Adnan gets a new trial, in which case the state has to, really within the next 6 months to a year, docket the trial, begin preparations. Or if they decide they don't want to go to trial because they have very little to go on at this point, they might offer him a plea deal or drop charges, something of that sort. But I don't see anything really happening significantly for at least a year. He'll remain incarcerated probably during that time.
And as we wrap up, we just got breaking news that a federal judge has apparently overturned the conviction of Brendan Dassey, the nephew of Stephen Avery, in the murder of Teresa Halbach here in Wisconsin. Both Avery and Dassey were at the center of the Netflix series Making a Murderer. We're still learning the details as to why the judge ordered this. But Rabia, as we wrap up, what do you think that says? And the movement on Adnan's case that the show that shows and podcasts like Serial or Making a Murderer can have.
That is fantastic. I'm hearing it from you myself, so I'm really happy to hear that. I think it was a grave miscarriage of justice in that case, both with Brendan and really, I also believe with Stephen Avery himself. I think what's happened is that, you know, this is proof positive that media and journalism, even citizen journalism, can really have an impact. And that's why I wanted to get a journalist involved. That's why I reached out to Sarah Koenig. And right now in our podcast, we Undisclosed, we are looking at a second wrongful conviction. And we also are fairly confident that we can help exonerate another young man.
We're going to have to leave it there, Rabia. Thank you so much for joining us today. Rabia Chowdhury is the author of Adnan's Story, The Search for Truth and Justice After Serial.
There was a time in America's culinary history when the food was maybe a touch bland.
Maybe you used salt and pepper, or if you were really cutting loose, a little oregano or paprika. But the palate was not terribly adventurous.
Fast forward to now, and the American food scene is exploding with flavors from all over the world, and herbs and spices like turmeric, cumin, and cilantro are becoming commonplace on supermarket shelves.
For this Food Friday, we're delving into spices, how to use them, and why experimenting with spices doesn't have to be as daunting as it may sound.
Joining us now to talk about spicing up our favorite foods is Floyd Cardoz. He's a chef, restaurateur, and the author of the new book, Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook the Foods You Love. Floyd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what does flavor walla mean?
So the word walla is a very common term in Hindi, which means someone who is a trader or a seller or an expert of a certain thing. So you would have, like my new restaurant's called Pawala, meaning someone who sells bread or who makes bread. Or you have chai walla, someone who sells chai or makes tea. So flavor walla was a term I used for my book because I believe that food should be full of flavor. And the way that most of us know to add flavor to food is to add cream or butter. Now, I dislike using cream or butter in my food. I love to eat it with bread, and I eat a lot of that on my bread. But I feel that you can make your food more interesting and more flavorful, if you will, if you add a bunch of little ingredients, you know, play with flavors. You know, one thing that people tell me about my food is that it's very exciting and it's got so much in there. So I use heat, I use saltiness, I use bitterness, I use sweetness, and I use a lot of texture to increase the flavor and mouthfeel of food.
Floyd, you're a chef and a restaurant owner. How did you end up on that path?
Oh, this is for me, it was not something I thought about doing when I was young. I grew up in Bombay, India, and I came to this country 28 years ago. But like most Indians, I thought that I would be a doctor or an engineer. And the plan was to go to medical school. After I finished my graduation, I decided that maybe I wasn't going to be a doctor, but maybe I'd be a biochemist or a marine biologist. And I happened to read a book. It was called Hotel, and it's by the American author Arthur Haley. And I was extremely intrigued by the hospitality world, and I thought, you know what? Maybe I should do this because this is something I enjoy. I also used to love food as a kid growing up and had to have good food every single day, which was common in my home to get really, really good food. But my entire day revolved around what we were going to eat for lunch, what I was going to eat for breakfast, what I was going to eat for dinner, and what I was going to eat for my snack. So when I went to hospitality school and I had to cook, I realized that I was really good at it. And that's when I decided that, you know what, maybe I should go work in a kitchen.
Well, Floyd, let's start getting into some spice advice. I have an idea of where I go wrong with using spices a lot. I put in spices, and I suspect, especially reading your book, that I put them in at the wrong time or in the wrong way, or I overcook them. Can you give us some general advice on how and when to use spices in our recipes?
So spices are basically roots, stems, flowers, or seeds of a plant. And the reason why they add so much of flavor is they've got essential oils. One of the questions I get asked pretty often is that, do I need to toast the spices? Well, you do need to cook the spices, but you could either do it in one of two ways. You can add it in, you can grind it and add it in a paste and cook it in oil. So you get all the essential oils into the oil, or you could toast it and then grind it and add it. So these are basically the two ways you can do it. You can either add them ground or you can add them whole. Now, if you're adding them whole, I would say use something like cumin or mustard seeds or clove, cinnamon, green cardamom, which you can pull out. Or you could eat, but if it's going to be something like a whole chili pepper, if you enjoy chili peppers, then put them in whole, but I would suggest you grind them and add them in. Now, if you add too much, it could take away from a dish, but most people who are afraid of spices, I say just start with things you know. You know black pepper, use black pepper. A lot of us enjoy Mexican food. Mexican food use a lot of chili peppers. They use a lot of cumin. So play with those ingredients that you know. Cinnamon, clove are great to add in rice, are great to add in stews. They just give you this little pop of flavor and change it just enough for you to think, wow, what is that? I really enjoy this. So start with small amounts. Don't go too crazy. But be very careful of certain spices like fenugreek. That is one of the hardest spices to use. And unless you're an expert at fenugreek, I would say stay away from it.
We're talking with Floyd Cardoz. He's a chef, restaurateur, and the author of Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook the Foods You Love. Now, Floyd, a lot of people are not just cooking for themselves or maybe themselves and a spouse, but there are also kids in the household. Kids can be a little hesitant about new flavors, dishes that they think are going to taste one way and they taste a different way. What's a good way that you have found to introduce kids to new spices and different ways of spicing kind of familiar foods?
So I have two sons who are now much older, but they were young, and on my days off, I would cook for them. And like most American kids, my sons were fussy and were afraid of eating a lot of things. Some of these fears came about from my wife, who was not a very adventurous eater, so she would translate that fear onto my sons. Now, most parents do that unintentionally. So what I started doing was I started playing with flavor and started giving them things that they enjoyed. Like, I knew my sons liked bacon. So pretty much a lot of things had bacon in it. So I'd do spinach, I'd throw bacon in it. I'd do beans, I'd throw bacon in it. I'd do bacon in everything so that they started trusting me. That was one thing I did. The second thing I did was I started playing games with them. So every time we'd cook dinner, I would either ask them to cook with me, and invariably we'd make something really simple. But the other thing that I would do is I would once we were sitting at the dinner table, we'd play a game, name that ingredient, and they would start picking things in the dish. Hmm. And one day I put kale in there, and they couldn't tell what it was. And I asked them, "Do you enjoy this?" And they said, "Oh, this is really good, Dad." And I told them that was kale. So we got kale into that diet. So I slowly added things into the dishes that they loved. You know, the other thing that I also love to do is say, "Hey, you choose what we're going to cook today, and we're going to cook it together and make it fun so you enjoy it." I held back on the chili pepper because kids don't like chili peppers. Kids don't like strong acids in their dishes. So not use acids, use a little bit of maple syrup or honey or sugar or orange juice, things that they kind of recognize and enjoy.
Let's start getting into some recipes now. Here's one we've got linked on our Central Time Facebook page from FlavorWalla. This is shrimp curry with cauliflower. First, talk about the flavors, the spices you're using in your shrimp curry with cauliflower.
So this is a dish that my great-grandmother made for my grandmother made for my mother made it for me, and I made it for my boys. So it's a very simple curry, and people often say, "Oh, I hate curry." Now, curry is such a generic term that I always tell them, just trust me, you're going to love the curry I make. So this is a very simple curry. It's got coconut milk, it's got turmeric, it's got black pepper, and it's got shrimp and cauliflower. All these things come together beautifully in this dish with a little bit of vinegar to cut the sweetness of the coconut milk. And the shrimp, when you cook them, you poach them gently in this curry. It makes it so easy to eat. Hey, it's not spicy. It's got turmeric in there, which is, we all know, has become, we realize that it's really, really good for you. You got a piece of vegetable in there, which is the cauliflower. And this could be on your menu most afternoons or most dinners. It's so easy to make.
Shrimp can be really delicious, but when it's overcooked, the texture can be a little less pleasant. What is a good tip for avoiding overcooking the shrimp?
So what I like to do with shrimp is, one thing that happens to shrimp is if you season it with salt too early, it tends to pull out all the moisture. That makes it makes it tough. So I tend to season shrimp just before I'm ready to cook them. And I kind of poach them gently in the sauce or grill them quickly so that it doesn't get a chance to get tough and disgusting, but it has this, like this, you know, you can almost get the sweetness of the shrimp and you can cut it easily and enjoy it. And poaching is a great way to cook, you know, if you have a thick piece of fish or shrimp, because you can control how much of heat you put to it. And once you put it in, you don't need to turn it. You don't need to play with it. You know, the fear comes from, what if I break the shrimp? What if I break the fish? So if you maintain a low temperature, chew it quickly, and you want to make sure that it's not transparent when you cook it. It gets a little bit opaque once you cook the shrimp.
We're talking to Floyd Cardoz, a chef, restaurateur, and the author of FlavorWalla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, a new way to cook the foods you love. And he's joining us to talk about adding spice to our meals.
And we want to hear from you. What's your favorite way to spice up recipes? Or maybe you want to know the best spice to add to your favorite everyday meals. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page or email your question to talk@wpr.org. Right now, it's Food Friday, and we're talking about adding spices to everyday meals. Do you have a favorite go-to spice that you like to cook with? Or maybe you'd like to make the leap and use new spices? Floyd is happy to help. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Find some recipes there. And again, call in with if you need some spice advice. 800-642-1234. Floyd Cardoz is with us. He's a chef, restaurateur, author of the new book, FlavorWalla. Floyd, I want to go to the grocery store with you now. I tend to buy, I'll admit, contrary to your book, I just tend to buy powdered spices in the little jars. You really make a push for stuff that you take home, either toast, like you said, or grind yourself. Convince me that I should start doing that.
So this is one of my favorite topics to talk about, because I've been into grocery stores where they have these jars of spices that you don't know when they were ground. Now, the beauty about spices is that they have essential oils which taste really good or are good for you, you know, for your health. So if you buy an old spice, most probably most of the oils have evaporated from there and they taste like like dust. So what I do at home, and I suggest this to everybody, you can get a small coffee grinder. There are plenty of them in the stores, and they cost between $11 and $18. I have one for coffee, and I have one for spices. And I buy small quantities of spices, 2 ounces, 3 ounces of spices. That's all you need to last about a month or even 2 months. Every year, I replenish my spices. So at the end of the season, I throw them away. I buy new spices. And you can buy that inexpensively online. Now, if you grind the spice as you need it, as soon as you open the cover, you get this amazing aroma. And that's the aroma that's going to make your food taste good. If you're going to open a jar which was supposed to be yellow, but it's brown now, it's not really going to taste good. So it just, if you add a little, goes a long way. Even turmeric, after a year or so, turmeric starts to lose some of its potency. Same with cayenne. A lot of people love cayenne, and we keep cayenne in our cabinets for months. So airtight jar, away from heat, away from light, hold spices, grind them as you need them. That's the best way to go about it.
So, Floyd, I have several favorite spices, but one is cardamom. And I'm wondering if you have any interesting ideas of how I can use cardamom.
Now, I love cardamom, too. But if you put too much again, it's not so good.
It can get bitter.
Always, it can get very bitter. And always get cardamom in the shell. So it comes with this green coating on the outside. Don't get the seeds, because I did some research on cardamom, and it's got a half-life of 14 days. So every 14 days when you grind it, it loses its flavor. I love using cardamom in desserts. Again, very, very little. I love using cardamom in meat stews. So if I'm doing lamb stew or making a chicken stew or a chicken curry, I start with whole cardamom in the oil as I start off. And then when it's ready, I pull it out. It works really well with vegetables. If you're making a pilaf, you can put cardamom in the pilaf with a little bit of clove and cinnamon, and it tastes really, really good. Just don't add too much, because once you add too much, it gets so floral, it almost tastes like soap.
That's too much. All right, definitely. Well, I want to get into another one of your recipes, another one we have shared on the Central Time Facebook page, Floyd. Pan-roasted broccoli with lime, honey, and chili flakes. And I'll say, I like this one in a lot of your recipes. Sometimes I look at a cookbook and think, yeah, that sounds nice, too complicated, not going to do it. This one and a lot of your recipes are easy enough that I would try them. Tell us about this pan-roasted broccoli.
So, you know, broccoli is an ingredient that is so misunderstood, because most of the time it's overcooked, it's mushy, it smells really bad, and that comes from over-steaming it or overcooking it in a pot. So I wanted my kids to eat green. How do I get them to eat green? So I started either grilling them or pan roasting them. And I'll do it in a pan or in the oven. Now, if you do plain broccoli, it's nice once a week. But if you want them to eat broccoli twice a week, you can give them the same thing, because you want them to want to eat it. So my idea is, how do I introduce these wonderful flavors into food? Because food gets interesting when you have a balance of sweet, sour, spicy, bitter, and salty. And the way I got that in was to add the lime juice, add the honey, and add the chili flakes. Because, and again, you could do less chili flakes or you could do more chili flakes, depending on how you like it. But I found that when I had the honey would play off the lime juice or lemon juice that you have, would play off the bitterness of the broccoli. And when you cook it in the oven quickly, it retains its bright green color. It has some texture to it, because obviously we want to eat with our eyes, our noses, and our mouth, because that's when food gets really good.
We're talking with Floyd Cardoz about his book, Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook the Foods You Love. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we had a comment from John. He says, I'm a Chinese American and soy sauce is at the center of so much of Chinese cuisine. Is there sort of an equivalent spice or ingredient that would fulfill that role in Indian cuisine? Floyd?
You know, I love using ginger. Ginger is so readily available in the United States today. But ginger adds, just put a little bit in anything you cook, makes it so interesting. So I think ginger from Indian cuisine is another ingredient that's used widely right now.
All right. Thanks for that comment, John. And we'll go to a caller now. Kyle is with us in Cottage Grove. Kyle, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kyle? Good.
Well, I moved to Wisconsin from California and love Indian food. And most of the Indian restaurants out there I eat at, when you would eat a hot curry, they would serve it with, it was like a, I'm not sure, but I think it was cucumber and maybe a yogurt condiment to kind of cool your mouth down. And I was wondering whether your guests might know something about that and how to create that at home.
Kyle, thanks a lot for that call. In addition to what he's specifically looking for, Floyd, can you also talk about that idea of balancing out the heat and the cool in a recipe?
Hey, Kyle, thanks for the call. That dish you're talking about is called raita, R-A-I-T-A. And it's a dish from the north of India. And it's basically, you can have a raita, which is cucumber with a little bit of salt, sugar, and a touch of cumin, if you want it or not, and chili pepper. And it could be made with cucumbers. It could be made with cucumbers and onions. It could be made with cucumbers, onions, and tomatoes. It could be made with pineapple. I love to make it with grated apples, when they're in season, and I add it to any roast pork that I do so I can get a bit of India with my traditional roast pork. But yogurt and tomato, normally an acid works extremely well when you have something spicy. The acid helps bring the heat down. So a raita is not eaten in all Indian homes, but it's eaten in the north, and Indian restaurants tend to normally make that. And it's very simple. You take a cucumber, you grate it. I like to get most of the liquid out of the cucumber, so I salt it a little bit and let it sit so I get a nice thick raita. Then I take the yogurt, whisk it very gently, because the more you whisk the yogurt, the looser it gets. Add, season it with salt, a little bit of sugar. I like to add toasted cumin in there, so I take whole cumin, I toast it in a pan until it turns fragrant and turns a slight color. I use my mortar and pestle and grind it, add it in there. Add the cucumber in there. Some people, if I'm eating lamb, I will add mint to it. If I'm eating chicken, I'll add cilantro to it. And sometimes I even add a little bit of chili pepper in summer, because with the heat, you need that heat in the dish to help bring your body's temperature down. So that's a great way to make your food a little milder.
So, Floyd, if we've gotten some of our listeners excited about trying some new spices, ready to branch out a little bit, try something new, what would you say is maybe not a totally foolproof, but a pretty easy new spice for people to start trying in maybe their usual chicken dish, or maybe something that they usually make with beef or a vegetable dish?
I would start with three, and you can get them. One is mustard seeds, and we're all very familiar with mustard powder, which comes from the ground up mustard seeds. I'd start with ground coriander, or sorry, take coriander seeds and grind them, and cumin. Now, with these three spices, you can make a rub for a steak. So you take coriander, cumin, and mustard, grind them, and crust your steak, and pan roast your steak. You can add it in a sauce, if you will. So if you're making a stew with onions and garlic, so add your onions and garlic, add your ground spices in there, add your red wine, if you will, or if you want to add tomatoes to it, and then add your meat in there. And let it cook in there. It'll just change the way it looks. And I love adding black pepper. And like I said earlier about ginger, if you like ginger, you add ginger to this mix, it'll change it. So every time you change the ratio of, say, the coriander or the cumin or the mustard seeds, it'll make a different dish.
Well, Floyd, thanks a lot. A lot of good inspiration there.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Floyd Cardoz. He's a chef, restaurateur, and the author of the book Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook the Foods You Love. He joined us for this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about spices you can use to liven up everyday meals. We have a couple of recipes we've talked about on our website at WPR.org, or find a link on the Central Time Facebook page. I've got a bumper crop, Judith, of cucumbers. I need to make some raita. I haven't made that in years. It doesn't travel well. I'm sorry. You got to eat it right away.
Well, you can make it here. Just bring all the raw ingredients, grate up that cucumber. I can bring the yogurt.
Yeah, in our super fancy Vilas Hall kitchen.
Yeah.
Again, get some inspiration and recipes. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, let us know about some of your spice experiments, failed or otherwise.
not in Kansas anymore.
Dorothy and Toto weren't in Kansas anymore. They were in Oz. And on this day in 1939, they were in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, where for reasons that aren't completely clear, The Wizard of Oz had its first openly publicized screening in its completed version.
As you said, Rob, there's some controversy over that. Wizard of Oz researchers, yes, there are Wizard of Oz researchers, say there may have been showings the day before in Appleton and Kenosha, as well as Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
But it's very clear Wisconsinites were among the first people to see this movie classic. After the showing at the Strand Theater in Oconomowoc, the film was shown in Sheboygan, Appleton, and Rhinelander. All of this came days before the official premiere in, where you'd think it would be, Hollywood.
Exactly. So I have a confession to make. I have always loved the flying monkeys, and it was a long time before I realized that people thought that was weird and even creepy.
It is a little bit weird and creepy, Judith. I'm not going to lie to you. Do you view them as the good guys in the movie?
Well, I also like bats. Don't you think it goes along with my liking bats?
Yeah, but the bats really are good guys. The flying monkeys really are bad guys.
You know, I think I always like kind of the tricksters in things. And I have to say, I actually think of the wizard as kind of the bad guy.
All right. Well, there's always the Pink Floyd option to watch Wizard of Oz. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.